From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll talk with Milwaukee Chief of Police Edward Flynn as he prepares to retire this month after 10 years in the MPD's top job.
Later, a Marquette University researcher studies how climate change is affecting an environment that people thought would be immune.
And what people thought initially was the biggest changes will happen at the poles. This is where we need to go. Ice sheets are going to melt. And this is happening. And they were right. People thought the tropics would be fairly stable. But we're starting to see big changes in the tropics.
And a show by the group Cooperative Performance celebrates the diverse stories of local immigrants.
Immigrant has become, I feel, synonymous with the word criminal lately in our political climate. And with this project, I'm hoping that, just in our own way, that we can humanize people.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Members of the public will have a chance to interact tomorrow evening with the three finalists for Milwaukee Interim Police Chief. The Fire and Police Commission cut the list down from nearly a dozen people who expressed interest in the job. The winner will replace, at least on a temporary basis, outgoing Chief Edward Flynn, who announced he'll retire after 10 years in the office later this month.
Flynn's tenure has been an eventful one. Violent crime has fallen, risen, and fallen again in that decade. There have been several high-profile officer-involved shootings that have strained the relationship between some members of the community and members of the force. But Flynn has also occasionally taken stances and actions that have put him at odds with the rank and file in his department. Chief Flynn joins us in the studio now to talk about his time in Milwaukee. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I guess I want to start by asking you to compare where you saw the Milwaukee Police Department itself when you were appointed as chief of police 10 years ago versus the state of the department as you see it today as you're preparing to leave.
I think it's important to look back at where Milwaukee was when I was hired in all the way back in January of 2008. At the time, Milwaukee's nickname had become Killwaukee. They had a 20-year average of close to 130 homicides a year, and that was the average. And there was a general perception that crime was at an extremely high rate, and it was injuring the city's economic competitiveness, as well as the health of its neighborhoods, and undermining attempts to restore those neighborhoods through economic development, as well as to continue the development of downtown and businesses and entertainment venues. So that was a major issue. The department had also had a couple of recent critical incidents that had undermined public confidence in the effectiveness of the agency or the ability of it to investigate itself. And so there was widespread consensus that change was needed. And fortunately for the city, it seems like a vanished age now, that consensus was across ideological lines. You know, there wasn't a big left-right thing going on. Something needed to be done about restoring the confidence and reputation of the department. Something needed to be done about the very high levels of crime that were plaguing the city. And they were willing to tolerate the second outsider in their history to come in and address those issues. Over the course of the next 10 years, we made some extraordinary progress. Obviously, the nature of the news business is to emphasize and underscore critical incidents that derive from conflict or error. But overwhelmingly, the trends have been positive. At the end of my first 4 years, the average number of homicides had been reduced from 127 to 81. Over the course of my second term, those numbers continued to decline, and we were, in a very good place. In 2015 and 2016, we had dramatic and sudden spikes in the homicide rate, notwithstanding the fact that over the course of those years, six of the lowest homicide totals in Milwaukee over the course of 25 years were recorded during those years. Certainly we saw some concerning trends in 15 and 16 last year. We saw a nearly 20% decrease in homicide, as well as decreases in six of the seven uniform crime index categories. So we regained our equilibrium. In terms of the agency's reputation, maybe we can get into it later if there's time, notwithstanding some of our recent critical incidents, the agency's achieved national recognition as a practitioner of evidence-based policing, as a practitioner of community-based policing, and as a practitioner of problem-oriented policing. And all of those things fit together, but we've received national and indeed international awards. A couple of years back, I got the Robert Peel Medal for evidence-based policing from Cambridge University in England. So I think we're in a much better place than we were. I know there's an entire, advocacy subgroup in this neighbor, in this community that wants to convince its city that we are in some sort of crisis. Nothing could be further from the truth, but police have been used for political purposes in the past, and that's certainly not surprising they're being used for political purposes now.
Well, and so what was the appeal in the job that you saw 10 years ago, what you might have considered the worthwhile challenge to Milwaukee that brought you here, and how did the last decade bear that out?
Well, I've, spent my adult life in policing. My first job out of college was working for the New Jersey Department of Public Welfare, and then I started a police career, and I've always believed that it was the preeminent, essential city service, and that its role, despite the centrality of its crime-fighting mission, is ultimately a form of social work. Even though cops have been griping about doing social work for my 40-plus year career, it's the essence of what we do. We have a society and a political establishment that's decided for a variety of years over the last few decades to basically fray the social safety net and to defund social services in the name of tax cuts. And so what we've got is reliance on the police to be the social agency of first resort for the poor, whatever it is, whether it's family troubles or the opioid crisis or the mental health crisis or any other crisis you can think of. If something is happening that shouldn't be happening, about which somebody should do something now, they call the police. And we are also expected to deal with crime where it occurs. And since crime overwhelmingly in our urban centers afflicts poor people of color, police efforts to intervene in that cycle of violence and do something about it inevitably leads some to accuse them of some form of bias, despite the fact that those are the neighborhoods not only most in need of police services, but the most requesting of those services. So I got involved in policing because I thought it was a noble profession that also needed to be fixed. And when you're 23 years old and you're freshly armed with a liberal arts degree, you actually think you can fix everything. And what I had to learn slowly but surely was that, we all start out at the bottom of policing and that we've got to earn our spurs. If we think we're going to be reformers, that's not done by standing outside, shaking your fist and yelling at the police department. It is done by getting into it, rolling your sleeves, understanding, developing some base level of empathy, but also developing the credibility and knowledge that you can be that reformer someday. And I had the benefit of an era of police reform that included paying for higher education. So I was able to get my master's and my PhD credits with the assistance of the federal government. I was able to go to some high-quality schools because of that. And I was also able to develop credibility having actually worked the streets. So, when time came to be a chief, and this is my fifth police chief job, I was thoroughly committed to connecting the department to the community, to emphasizing the essential role of uniformed patrol officers and to elevate that role and to make them the real focus of our efforts. And I also was aware of the importance of technological improvements and the application of research findings to police practice. And so Milwaukee was a city that was clearly in need of all of those things, and I was greatly attracted to the opportunity to bring those approaches to our challenge here in this city.
You made reference to the criticisms that have been leveled, sometimes from the community at large. There have been criticisms occasionally within the department. Is that par for the course for a chief of police?
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons I stay very actively involved in places like the Police Executive Research Forum or the Major City Chiefs Association is I feel it's my obligation to be able to not only learn from other experiences, but also to contextualize our own. There's an unhappy habit among local journalists and local politicians to act as though everything that happens in Milwaukee generally bad, very seldom good. The good does, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the, you know, Mark Antony's funeral oration about, you know, Caesar, you know, the evil men do live after them. The good is often turned with their bones. Well, I frequently feel people are digging ditches for all the good we've done these last 10 years in order to emphasize those aspects of the narrative that that support their political agendas. So, you know, having said that, you know, the challenge is moving forward, you know, making sure that we've got people ready to continue this evolution of the department, but also recognizing that the community is not a monolith. I mean, one of the most frustrating questions I would get from somebody from the news media would be, well, Chief, the community is distrustful of the police. And I'd say, okay, well, you know, well, wait a minute. You know, which community here? Okay. I mean, you know, back in 2015, I mean, we saw the results of a community satisfaction survey that was conducted at the height of all the Ferguson and the Red Arrow Park demonstrations that indicated 75% of the community had had confidence in the police department. I mean, that doesn't count. That doesn't matter. A year and a half ago, the mayor ran for re-election. His opponent on the city council had one issue, public safety, and the mayor got 70% of the vote. I mean, theoretically, that should mean as much as anybody who's able to get their face on a camera saying something controversial about the police department. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't understand that we inherit a social history that hasn't always been positive, and it doesn't mean that I don't understand that there have been times the police department under my watch has conducted has engaged in wrongdoing. And we've exposed it, all right? We've made the arrests of our own people. We brought charges against our own people. You know, the key is that the institution has responded professionally to all its challenges, both the external challenges as well as internal challenges that arise from time to time in every big city police department. I mean, I look at the lay of the land. I mean, police departments get sued. There are payouts. You know, we don't, you know, take these things for granted. We're not cavalier about them. We're not complacent about them. We're constantly working to eliminate risk to the community, both in terms of safety as well as in terms of civil suits. But we recognize that we're in a dynamic profession. Sometimes things are going to go wrong, and sometimes people are going to bring actions that perhaps are ill-founded, but nonetheless will get a lot of publicity. So, yeah, it's a part and parcel of dealing with, you know, one of the most complex community functions there is, and that's the policing function. And we are policing the most violent, heavily armed populace in the so-called industrialized world. And that creates a level of stress that's significant.
Police Chief Edward Flynn speaking with us this week. We'll have more of his conversation with us after a quick break. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Let's get back to our conversation with Edward Flynn, who steps down this month after 10 years as chief of the Milwaukee Police Department.
In the first half of our interview, Flynn talked about the realization early in his career that police officers were not in a position to fix everything. I asked him at this stage, what is it that police can't fix that's hardest to accept?
Well, right now, my frustration as a civic leader is my inability to get this community to engage in adult conversation about the intersection of poverty, race, and crime. Nobody wants to talk about that. People want to point fingers and yell at the top of their lungs. And that's very frustrating. I mean, I've said before, you know, I go over to City Hall and I'm going into like this alternate reality of what exists in the community. And I can literally go to a committee meeting in City Hall in the morning and get berated for being ineffective in the fight against crime and being too soft on crime. And in the afternoon or evening, be berated by another committee because we're engaged in racial profiling and we have unconscious bias. Now, the challenge for us is to confront a significant problem, okay? And the problem is poverty and its many symptoms. Now, you know, my friends in the health department don't get attacked for the amount of time they spend in disadvantaged neighborhoods on low birth weight babies, premature births, co-sleeping deaths, and STDs. They don't get attacked for that. They are where it's needed. And the fire department doesn't get attacked for going into those same neighborhoods where there's the greatest concentration of substandard and dilapidated housing and putting out fires and installing smoke detectors. The police are called to those same communities, those same neighborhoods, and the symptom of poverty we're asked to deal with is violent crime. And the numbers are daunting, and they're numbers that politicians don't want to talk about. In this city and in most of the urban centers of America, over 80% of our homicide victims are African American. Over 80% of our aggravated assault victims, over 80% of our non-fatal shooting victims, and the highest percentage of victims of every single other crime. Okay, that's truncating lives, that's ending lives, it's destroying neighborhoods, it's preventing their reemergence as places where people can safely do business. And we're supposed to do something about it with the neighborhoods. Now, at the same token, we recognize that our interventions, if we're not careful, can be experienced as alienating. But no matter what, there are going to be racial disparities in our interventions that match our victimization populations. I can't seem to have that conversation at the same time. All right? One group's going to yell at me because we're doing too much policing in the same neighborhoods that people live are yelling at us because we're not protecting them well enough. And I've said this to President Obama at the town hall when I was invited to ask that question. I've said this in numerous venues. There's a rich conversation to have about real or perceived police abuse or disparities. But there's also an equally important, relevant, and intimately connected conversation to have about disparate victimization and the impact of violent crime on neighborhoods characterized by high rates of intergenerational poverty. And the needle hasn't moved in Milwaukee on that discussion, and the discussion hasn't moved nationally. I mean, not long ago, we had this wonderful situation in which two of our officers raced to the scene of a car that had flipped over and was on fire and almost could have lost their lives crawling into the flaming car to pull out three young men and save their lives. Now, that was a wonderful story. But nowhere was the headline, two white officers risk lives to save three young African-American males. And people would rightly say, well, it doesn't matter. And I would agree. But if the officer had been chasing one of them and shot one of them for some crime, it would have been in the first sentence in the story, immediately implying ill intent on the other side of the officer. And incidentally, these three young men were fine young men, not criminally involved, and, you know, very, very fine young men going to school. But my point is that we are so obsessed with one side of the equation that we risk putting the police in a position where they are delegitimized in those very neighborhoods where they are needed most importantly. And I just wish that as we were going through this process of selecting another police chief, that folks would expand the discussion beyond the self-styled advocacy community that seems to be dominating this process right now and maybe reach out to all of the neighborhoods of this city to see what it is they think the department should do as it moves further into the 21st century.
Is there a role at the risk of criticizing my own profession that you see the news media ought to play in this to keep it from just being a Black Lives Matter versus a Blue Lives Matter conversation?
Well, right now, I'm speaking in generalities. And first of all, I'll do a disclaimer. You know, I know there's a lot of people who go into the news business because they want to be real journalists, and real journalism has an essential role to play in a democracy, okay? So I'm not speaking from just the standpoint of somebody who's often felt aggrieved at his own news coverage. I'm seeing a real problem here. And one of the problems in the local news, and it doesn't matter where I travel, I'm going to a conference somewhere, I turn on the news, I see the exact same thing I see here in Milwaukee. The first four news stories are going to be in wherever your disadvantaged neighborhood is, young African-American men who've shot each other. That is going to lead the news every night. Then it's going to be the weather. Then it's going to be a sports hit. And then it'll be other news. Now, you'll see that every night of the week until then we find a story on a body-worn camera where an officer uses force, perhaps inappropriately or apparently inappropriately, against a young man of color. That will become national news. And we will act like there are these two different worlds of the crime propaganda the local news puts out every night about its central city and then the anti-police propaganda it puts out when there's a real or perceived police abuse. That's what I'm talking about when I'm saying you can't afford to delegitimize this important agency of what is, in fact, social control. Accountability is not the same thing as vilification. And too many people in the ongoing conversation can't seem to draw a distinction between holding officers accountable for misconduct, differentiating misconduct from error, which happens in a dynamic environment, and not attempting to delegitimize this essential service in the neighborhoods where it's most desperately needed. And that means being able to, you know, draw a distinction between disparities that are generated by the reality of the concentration of poverty and what it means and what its various symptoms are, as opposed to disparities that might be subject to a different interpretation. No one's talking about those things. Nobody's making documentaries about them. The data dumps I find cynical, okay? When 80% of the people in this community that are shot are poor people of color, and we lock up folks who look just like them for doing it, then we're accused of, you know, mass incarceration. I mean, help me out here. All right, there's problems to grapple with. But as long as the elected politicians can get away with simple solutions to complex problems for which they can blame civil servants, then nothing will change. And right now here in Milwaukee, the politicians are talking about the low-hanging fruit. There's not one of them that's got a plan or a policy or a consensus on what it will take to deal with the systemic problems of those neighborhoods in any sort of orderly way. And that's a tragedy here, and it's a tragedy in other cities.
Well, so there's currently this involved process to appoint the interim chief of police, which is, I gather, not always the way that sort of appointment happens. How do you see that affecting the department in the short run and the presumably broader search that will follow?
It's a dreadful idea what they're doing. The Fire and Police Commission doesn't know how to do a search. Now, I wouldn't expect them to ask me because they haven't talked to me for the better part of a year. But I can tell you, you know, you can talk to the people who run the Major City Chiefs Association, the Police Executive Research Forum, or search firms. Nobody does a process like this for the interim chief. By definition, the interim chief holds the chair, you know, keeps the trains running on time, so to speak, provides some level of stability while a more thoughtful and involved process is done to select a permanent successor. Now, this group has come up with this, you know, community process now, which pits members of the senior command staff against each other for theoretically a temporary job, at the end of which they are going to have to work with the same people they just competed with and then perhaps compete with them a second time. Now, that's inherently destabilizing. Now, I've seen the chairman of the commission quoted as saying, well, maybe we'll give the interim chief a 2-year term, or maybe we'll let them serve a 4-year term, or like, how do I interview a job when I don't even know what the job is or how long I'm going to have it? So it's the interest of I don't know what. They've come up with a process that supposedly involves the community, but doesn't. It involves the activists, you know, the 20 people who show up at a meeting and yell about things. They're going to show up and they're going to yell at a couple of community meetings, and then the FPC is going to select the chief. And as far as I can tell, the most important qualification is of the newest chief is going to be that he's not me. So and I say he because those are all they're interviewing right now. So in the interest of professionalism, and I mean this sincerely aside from my sarcasm a moment ago, you know, that the process of every other city in the country is you elevate the number two person to hold the fort, and then you do a nationwide search that involves some level of community input and some stable, predictable series of processes that result in a definite term of office. I'm mystified. You know, this commission came up with finalists in about a week or a week and a half. I mean, we don't come up with finalists for the assistant chief job that fast. I mean, we really actually look at their resumes. We actually read their resumes. I mean, and read their, you know, policy statements. I mean, there's a number of officers that I was confounded didn't make the cut. I don't know why the cut was artificially to 3 right away. I mean, certainly the commission's got plenty of time to interview candidates. So I think it's a fundamentally flawed process, and the flaws in the process are certainly obvious to the members of the department. And I'd hate to see the person that sits in that chair, be perceived as the product of a flawed process rather than a thoughtful professional one.
Well, and as you say, not that the Fire Police Commission has asked you, but what would you see as the most important quality that the next chief has?
You've got to be able to do a number of things, okay? The essence of the job is balance. As I indicated before, my ability to make both, you know, the folks in Madison mad at me because I'm seen as too aggressive on firearms, and then, you know, the ACLU mad at me because they see me as too aggressive on crime. You've got to be willing to risk the displeasure of political actors. I've never been afraid to do that. And the way of running a police department is oriented towards the solving of problems, not the validating of ideological templates. You know, our problem with governing right now is both the left and the right have adamant ideas of how the world should be, but neither one of them seem willing to confront the world as in fact is, and that responding to real world problems requires a balance of approaches, some of which may be, quote, conservative, some of which are, quote, liberal. But the point is we require a variety of approaches that are evidence-based, and evidence isn't ideological, and that's a challenge for us. So the number one thing I think is balance and a commitment to problem solving, not a commitment to reducing the amount of criticism leveled at the department. The rest of it is, you know, continuing to build, adapt, and innovate. You know, I'm leaving a department behind that I think is organizationally sound and operationally high performing. We also, you know, bequeath and have inherited our own set of social issues that will require constant work. But the loudest spokespeople aren't necessarily the most reliable partners. That there are neighborhoods out there whose locally based leaders work with this department every day on neighborhood problems. They're always marginalized when the issues become, quote, citywide issues and television issues. But they're there. They call us. They work with us. They partner with us, as do numerous numbers of community-based organizations that are doing real good. And it disturbs me that the folks that are actually laboring in the vineyard, so to speak, are so often marginalized when the so-called community conversations take place at City Hall.
What can you tell us about your plans after you leave office?
My number one plans are to, you know, reconsolidate households and you know, be available for my children and grandchildren. I suspect, you know, at some point in time, I will start to get really fidgety and annoying to be around and perhaps do some consulting. But I think my days as becoming, I'm not even going to qualify it. You know, my days of, you know, leading, you know, government organizations and dealing full time with politicians will happily be behind me. And it's going to take me at least a few weeks to, I think, de-stress from that and, you know, prepare for my next stage.
Well, Chief Flynn, thank you so much for your time and best of luck to you.
Listen, thanks for the questions. You've always been fair. This is one of those news sources in the city that it's valuable and clearly isn't always chasing ratings, but providing a real service. And I hope you keep it up.
Well, thank you so much. Nice of you to say.
Thanks.
Edward Flynn retires later this month after 10 years as Milwaukee's police chief. This is an edited version of the interview. You can hear the entire interview with him at WUWM.com.
The Police and Fire Commission will hold a closed-door session with the finalists for interim police chief tomorrow. Michael Brunson, Assistant Chief James Harpole, and Captain Alfonso Morales will take questions from the public in a forum afterwards. We'll have a report on that event Friday morning on Lake Effect.
We'll take another break now and then meet a Marquette University professor doing pioneering work on tropical vines. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. It has been a cold and snowy week in Milwaukee, but there's at least one professor at Marquette University who really hasn't noticed. Stefan Schnitzer spends months at a time at his forested lab. It's an island in the Panama Canal waterway called Barro, Colorado.
Schnitzer and his team are focused primarily on a native woody vine, or liana, that climbs up the canopy of trees. Lake Effect Susan Bentz met Schnitzer at his Marquette lab before he set off for Panama. He explained what he's learning about lianas and its impact on tropical forests and beyond.
These vines are actually spread across hundreds of different species, right? And probably a quarter of all of the plant families have some sort of vine-like growth form. So they're really, really ecologically diverse and taxonomically diverse. So they've evolved multiple times. So it's a very successful way to be a plant. What's happening now is the forests are changing enough to where they seem to be thriving when many trees are not thriving as much. So some of the, for example, the forests we're working in where we have some of our really large-scale studies, tree population numbers tend to be going down a little bit where the liana population numbers are increasing. Early in climate change research, the 1990s, which wasn't so long ago, but this is really when we started to notice these large-scale trends that were actually trends, because we didn't really start seeing these big spikes in temperature and CO2. Well, CO2 levels were going up, temperature started going up, and the weather started to change in the 80s and 90s. But in the 80s and 90s, we couldn't distinguish climate from weather. We didn't know if it was just a series of strange dry years. But when 15 out of your last 16 years have been record-setting temperatures, I mean, this indicates that all of the theory for what should happen when you release these greenhouse gases into the air in terms of heating up the environment, well, this is exactly what we're seeing. And so it's a pretty good ecological test, even though we only have one Earth, so we're only replicating it once, right? But it's exactly what you would predict, and this is what's happening. And what people thought initially was the biggest changes will happen at the poles. This is where we need to go. You know, the ice sheets are going to melt, glaciers are going to melt, and this is happening. And they were right. People thought the tropics would be fairly stable, but we're starting to see big changes in the tropics now. And these forests are now transitioning into different forests. They tend to have slightly longer dry seasons. Their plants are more water stressed. And in many of these communities, the tree species that are drought tolerant seem to be doing a little bit better, and the ones that aren't seem to be doing a little bit worse.
What I read was that you were following sort of what was conventional science and research when you started in, but you've taken a giant leap. How has your research changed, or how has the research changed over your time of studying?
Well, we've always been testing broad conceptual theory in ecology, and we're still testing broad conceptual theory in ecology. I guess the difference is now we're starting to see these forests change, and we happen to be studying one of the groups of plants that is benefiting a lot from these changes. And so in a way, my work is a little bit more applied, but that's just one arm of my research program. We're still studying the same kind of conceptual theoretical ideas in ecology because those last, right? Those aren't fad areas where you say, oh, something's happening, let's go and study that, and then 5 years later something else is happening, so you have to drop everything and go study a different thing. When you start studying fundamental questions in the field, you can apply those to all of the bigger changes that are happening, and that's what we are trying to do.
Is part of your research setting off plots and removing the vine from some areas and not others and see what a difference that makes in what's growing in those plots?
Right. Well, initial grant from the National Science Foundation to do this work was to look at the ecosystem ramifications of changing tropical forests. And so if we remove the vines, what would we expect to see in terms of carbon sequestration? Tropical forests are critical ecosystems for the planet because they store about 40% of the terrestrial carbon. And so when you start getting changes to tropical forests, even small changes that release carbon means that there's a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's not being pulled into these terrestrial ecosystems like tropical forests. And so that was the motivation for this grant. But there were also other conceptual motivations, like if we could explain why things are taking advantage of different periods of the year, like say for the example, the dry season, we could also start to look at what mechanisms explain the distribution of plants, which is one of the fundamental questions in ecology. I mean, why are there so many species, and what mechanisms explain plant distributions and animal distributions are two really fundamental questions. And if we understand and answer those questions, we can then say we will have very strong predictions of what species should do well under a changing climate scenario.
So over your time there, has the abundance and actually the number of species of plants declined?
Yeah, some have, and some have increased quite a bit. And so right now we're finishing a census that has taken us about 2 years of about 65,000 individuals that we censused initially in 2006, 2007.
And we 65,000 what's?
Vines.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. This is why I have a full-time field crew that is doing this work. And at this point, they're far more experienced than I am. So they're out there doing this work 5 days a week, and we're almost on, and we will be able to quantify. And the reason why we need so many individuals is because there are about 200 species, 180 species right now, and we're finding new ones. And you have to have enough replication to where you can actually notice a clear trend in change. So out of those 180 species, we have about 100 species where we have enough replication to where 10 years later, we will be able to say, these groups are increasing, these other groups are decreasing. And we'll be able to trace that back to the functional characteristics of those species and say, oh, these ones are increasing because they do very well under drought conditions, if that's the case. And that's our prediction. And some of these other ones that are decreasing may not be as drought adapted. And so that's the prediction, and we'll see if that is the truth. But this all came about from our work on fundamental basic research questions about what explains the distribution of these organisms. And we're finding a lot of them are distributed in these very dry seasonal forests. And these are the ones that seem to be doing really well. And so whether they're doing really well, we'll know after we analyze these data.
You bring a lot of money to this research. What do other scientists and science organizations hope this can achieve? What we need to protect? How we can adapt?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, what we need to protect, but also what's really happening in these forests. It's only when you start studying big chunks of the forest, and then you have to start doing manipulations to quantify what the significance really is. I mean, you can say, well, this group is increasing and that other group is decreasing, but some people would view that carbon storage in tropical forests is a zero-sum game, right? If one plant outcompetes another one, it just takes its carbon, and carbon stays fairly stable over time. And so who cares if there's plant A or plant B or the pink plant or the yellow plant? Doesn't matter, right? What we're finding is that that assumption is absolutely false. When we get an increase in some of these groups and a decrease in others, it is not a zero-sum game, and these tropical forests seem to be pulling up less carbon and storing less carbon over time. And that's a huge concern, because this could be one of these positive feedback loops which liberates more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. As temperatures go up, it will start getting faster and faster, and the forest will not take in as much carbon as we expect them to absorb.
So a figure that's sticking in my brain is 76%.
Yes, 76% is the number that our data hold us, and that's per year. 76% less carbon uptake. Now hold on. This is the whole effect. It's not the slight increase effect. That we're still working out the numbers for. The 76% effect is the effect that lianas have on tropical forest carbon uptake, and you can call it accumulation. Right? Mm-hmm. And so if you didn't have those vines, forests would be storing a lot more carbon. And the reason why this happens is these vines tend to have fairly small volume, but they displace the volume in trees. 95% of the carbon in tropical forests is in the trunks of trees and in the soil, but most is in the trunks of trees. The vines are not a fraction of the size of these large trees, but they stop the large trees from growing, and they increase the mortality of these trees. So what they do is they're increasing carbon cycling fluxes, and that's bad, because that means more carbon is going into the air and then slowly being pulled out. What we want from these forests is that they pull the carbon in and hold them into a tree trunk for 1,000 years. And that's what we would expect.
Ecologist and biologist Stefan Schnitzer spends part of his year at Marquette University, where he is the Mellon Distinguished Professor of Biology. The other part of the year is spent at his lab in Panama, and he spoke with Susan Bentz.
One last break, and then the stories of local immigrants adapted for the stage in Cooperative Performance's new show, Ellis. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Rich Tyke. Immigration and the stories of immigrants are front and center in this country today, from the debate over the future of DACA to the proposed border wall, no-fly lists, and travel bans. It is a challenging time to be an immigrant in this country.
But Kelly Coffey and Don Russell of Cooperative Performance thought there were stories that we're not hearing. So they, along with actor and immigrant Alejandro Gonzalez, joined me in the studio to talk about the genesis of their new project called Ellis.
It's something I've been thinking about for a while that I wanted to do. Just theater in general, I think, should have more voices, more stories that don't generally get to be told. And immigrant has become, I feel, synonymous with the word criminal lately in our political climate. And with this project, I'm hoping that just in our own way that we can humanize people, that people can see it and rethink maybe what they've been told.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me. It was probably, what, about 2 years ago now that Kelly first brought up the idea.
Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah.
So this was before any real major issues with immigration being a major hot topic, politically speaking. Mm-hmm. We had no idea it would be this politically charged at this point in time, that the political situation of immigration would have deteriorated so much in just 2 years.
What do you think theater can do in this situation? What kind of dialogue can theater foster that maybe other forms of discourse can't?
We really love to collaborate and to have the community involved. And I think theater is a great way because you're live. You know, you come to a performance, people are actually there as opposed to watching TV at home, you know, in isolation with these topics. So we have people who will probably be doing some talkbacks as well with the cast. And I think this one is an important one. This is probably the most global cast we've ever had from so many different backgrounds. And I think theater generates that conversation. At least it's what we're hoping to do, particularly with this piece. So people can ask questions. I think that there is a lot of misinformation right now about the immigration situation. So I just think that theater is a great way to involve the community.
Yes, I think what's beautiful about theater in these sort of circumstances is you're breathing the same air as the people on stage. And though we do have regular performers who are not immigrants, we also do have performers who are living the life of an immigrant in this country and everything that entails. And what else we wanted to do with Ellis was not just simply stand on a soapbox and say, hey, this is our belief on what immigration should be and what immigration policy should be. What we wanted to do was something different. We wanted to take with this piece the idea that we find often in political discourse, the humans being discussed become dehumanized. So immigrant becomes this idea rather than a person. And we wanted to rehumanize immigrants in this country. So what we did was not necessarily take stories of horrible experiences with ICE or whatever that might be. What we wanted to do was to take stories that were both struggles but also joys.
So essentially human experience.
So that the audience can watch this thing and say, hey, I identify with that. I had an experience similar to that. I can see where that person would feel this way or think this thing. And they're just human beings like me, not some talking point.
So Alejandra, is this the first time you've done theater?
No, I've actually have been active in the Milwaukee theater community for the past 6 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I started in high school.
So this is not something new to you, but is putting your story on stage this way new?
It is, yeah. It's something that in the last 2 years, I've always wanted to do. I always wanted to provide a platform for immigrant stories. And so when Kelly and Don reached out to me, I was more than happy to be on board.
What was your process? I mean, had you already had some ideas in mind about what kinds of your stories that you wanted to tell?
It was really hard because what I do essentially is I do go around and tell my personal story, what the process was like, you know, how my parents brought me over when I was young, the struggles that I've had to endure. But when I was writing for this show, it was just it came from an educational standpoint because that's what I do. I try to educate people on immigrant experiences. So I actually ended up falling back on meeting my boyfriend. That's what my story is about. And coming out to him as being undocumented. So that it's this really beautiful moment that I'm afraid is going to be tarnished by my immigration status, but it turns out we're still very happily together. So it's that I wanted to kind of share that experience of, like, not only am I dealing with dating anxiety, I'm also dealing with having to come out about my immigration status to somebody.
Right. And depending on the person, that could be very dangerous for you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's not something I usually do when I was single. That's not something I would talk about because I didn't know what would happen to me, to my safety. So it took me a while to actually come out to Ian, and he was just like, it was nothing. I mean, it was something to him, but it wasn't such a big deal. He was totally okay with that.
So where are you on your status? Are you still undocumented, or
I'm currently protected by DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. I'm not due for a renewal until June, and then I'll get 2 more years if I can still renew by then. I can choose to renew before then, but I would lose out on a year. But as of now, I'm protected till October of this year.
And so what is the status for you in terms of becoming a citizen or a green card holder? Are you in that process while you're covered under DACA?
I currently don't have a pathway. My only pathway to becoming a green card holder is getting married. And that's not something I want to pressure anybody into doing for me. And that's not the way I want to get married. That's not the reason why I want to get married, because that's not me. That's not how I define myself. So as of now, I'm kind of, after my DACA expires, and if I'm not able to renew it, I go back to square one. I go back to being undocumented.
So this performance then is, it's personal, but it's like really personal. I mean, you're telling a story that, you know, a lot of people, again, as Don was saying, you know, it's just a talking point. It's like, oh, there's these DACA people. I don't know any of them. Or I don't think I know any of them. So it's not really my problem. It's their problem.
Right. And people don't realize that there are, I mean, even I don't know who around me is. We call them documented until they come out to me. So it's kind of crazy when you realize my neighbor, you know, or in my case, my nanny. You know, I used to be a nanny for 6 years. And again, I have a very supportive people that I've worked for, and I love them. Can I give them a shout out?
Sure.
Hi, Max. Hi, Ben. Hi, Sam. But yeah, it's. I mean, I was reading stories about a pastor who was on DACA and is facing deportation. So these are community members. These are people that just want to live their lives. And they're not able to, for whatever reason. You know, sometimes it's the fear, it's the anxiety, or it's just not having the ability to reach that potential.
Now, Kelly and Don, when you've got people like Alejandra and others like her who have this status that is unknown, was that a consideration when you were putting this together that you might, quote unquote, out people?
Oh, absolutely. That's something that I talked to Alejandra about right away. I mean, even just, you know, taking photos or something, you know, I want to make sure everybody's comfortable or not, you know. And that's an interesting question, too, because when we were gathering stories, we put out a call for submissions on social media. So anybody could submit their story of immigration, whether it's their own or their parents. And I thought we would get, you know, sort of a lot of response, and we didn't. And then, you know, with the political climate as it was like, yeah, people are afraid about what's going on. I mean, it's real, and it does. It affects all of us. Even, you know, if you're not an immigrant, they're ripping families apart, communities apart. And if you think this doesn't affect you, it does. It affects everyone.
Just it affects some more than others.
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it kind of concerns me, and the way it can actually concern just the regular natural-born citizens is we're watching rights being taken away from general citizenry. I mean, just recently, what is it? ICE can now start tracking license plate numbers and seeing who potential undocumented immigrants are are what consorting with. Well, that's a huge step forward in encroaching on our rights as citizens, you know, regardless of you know, whether we're immigrants or not immigrants. Every citizen now has that sort of encroachment.
So do you think, going back to the, you know, how can theater do this better than other things, or are there ways of talking about it, do you think and hope that this is going to spark a conversation within the community?
Yes.
The general community, not just the immigrant community.
Yes. I think more people should be talking about it because this is a platform to educate people, as Alejandro was saying, which I think is important. Like I had mentioned before, I think that there's a lot of misinformation. I mean, I learned a lot just by talking to Alejandra. I mean, I knew some of this issue, but there's so much more that that we don't know, that the general public just does not know.
And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to make sure this wasn't going to be some sort of political soapbox piece.
Right.
We wanted to make sure that it was something that perhaps someone who is for tougher immigration laws would be able to watch this piece and not feel like they're being shouted at, but that they're having a conversation. It's something that I feel like we've lost in this country is the ability to have civil discourse. Mm-hmm. And a piece like this opens up the opportunity for conversation rather than shutting one segment of a political perspective down. Like shutting them up, essentially,
right.
Because if people don't feel like they have agency or voice, they're just going to entrench in their political beliefs.
It's been my experience when I approach people like humans, how I hope to be approached, they really open up, and then they're kind of just shocked at the information that they didn't know. So I definitely believe that education is the best way to fight ignorance. Sometimes people just really aren't informed. So I'm hoping that this piece allows them to seek out that information a little bit more. I, for one, I'm kind of just tired of having to humanize myself. I kind of just want to live a normal life without having to justify my existence in this country that I do consider my home. And I'm hoping this piece kind of gives a little window to that perspective.
And so what's next for you once this is over?
Well, my DACA expires in the fall, so I'm going to try to travel as much as I can before then while I still have that ability. Otherwise, just focus on school. I'm a sophomore at El Verno College. I'm majoring in community leadership and development and just kind of working towards educating more and more people on immigration.
Well, best of luck.
Thank you.
And Kelly and Don, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate all of you coming in so early in the morning.
Thank you. We're grateful for you.
Much, Bonnie. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Don Russell and Kelly Coffey of Cooperative Performance created Ellis. Alejandra Gonzalez is one of the performers. The show opens Friday and runs through February 24th at El Verno College's Pittman Theater with a free show at Milwaukee City Hall on the 18th. There is more information at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.